Chapman arranged to meet Rosemary Barr and the firm's investigator at his law offices. The investigator was a retired cop, shared by most of the city's law firms. They all had him on retainer. He was a private detective with a license. His name was Franklin. He was nothing like a private eye in a TV show. He did all his work at a desk, with phone books and computer databases. He didn't go out, didn't wear a gun, didn't own a hat. But he had no equal as a fact-checker or a skip-tracer, and he still had plenty of friends in the PD.
"The evidence is rock solid," he said. "That's what I'm hearing. Emerson was in charge, and he's pretty reliable. So is Roden, really, but for a different reason. Emerson's a stiff, and Roden is a coward. Neither one of them would be saying what they're saying unless the evidence was there."
"I just can't believe he did it," Rosemary Barr said.
"Well, certainly he seems to be denying it," Chapman said. "As far as I can understand him. And he's asking for someone called Jack Reacher, someone he knows or used to know. You ever heard that name? You know who he is?"
Rosemary Barr just shook her head. Chapman wrote the name Jack Reacher on a sheet of paper and slid it across to Franklin.
"My guess is he may be a psychiatrist. Mr. Barr brought the name up right after I told him how strong the evidence is. So maybe this Reacher guy is someone who can help us out with the mitigation. Maybe he treated Mr. Barr in the past."
"My brother never saw a psychiatrist," Rosemary Barr said.
"To your certain knowledge?"
"Never."
"How long has he been in town?"
14 years, since the army.
"Were you close?"
"We lived in the same house."
"His house?"
Rosemary Barr nodded.
"But you don't live there anymore." Rosemary Barr looked away.
"No. I moved out."
"Might your brother have seen a shrink after you moved out?"
"He would have told me."
"Okay. What about before in the service?"
Rosemary Barr said nothing. Chapman turned back to Franklin.
"So maybe Reacher was his army doctor? Maybe he has information about an old trauma. He could be very helpful."
Franklin accepted the sheet of paper.
"In which case, I'll find him."
"We shouldn't be talking about mitigation anyway," Rosemary Barr said. "We should be talking about reasonable doubt, about innocence."
"The evidence is very strong," Chapman said. "He used his own gun."
Franklin spent 3 hours failing to find Jack Reacher. First, he trawled through psychiatric associations. No hits. Then he searched the internet for Gulf War support groups. No trace. He tried LexisNexis and all the news organizations. Nothing. Then he started back at the beginning and accessed the National Personnel Record Center's database. It listed all current and former military. He found Jack Reacher's name in there easily enough. Reacher had entered the service in 1984 and received an honorable discharge in 1997. James Barr himself had signed up in 1985 and mustered out in 1991, so there was a 6-year overlap. But Reacher had been no kind of a doctor, no kind of a psychiatrist. He had been a military cop, an officer, a major, maybe a high-level investigator. Barr had finished as a lowly specialist E4. Infantry, not military police. So what was the point of contact between a military police major and an infantry E4? Something helpful, obviously, or Barr wouldn't have mentioned the name, but what? At the end of 3 hours, Franklin figured he would never find out because Reacher fell off the radar after 1997. Completely and totally. There was no trace of him anywhere. He was still alive, according to the Social Security Administration. He wasn't in prison, according to the NCIC, but he had disappeared. He had no credit rating. He wasn't listed as title holder to any real estate or automobiles or boats. He had no debts, no liens, no address, no phone number, no warrants outstanding, no judgments entered. He wasn't a husband, wasn't a father. He was a ghost. James Barr spent the same 3 hours in serious trouble. It started when he stepped out of his cell. He turned right to walk down to the payphones.
The corridor was narrow. He bumped into another guy shoulder to shoulder. Then he made a bad mistake. He took his eyes off the floor and glanced at the other guy and apologized. A bad mistake because a fish can't make eye contact with another prisoner, not without implying disrespect. It was a prison thing. He didn't understand. The guy he made eye contact with was a Mexican. He had gang tattoos, but Barr didn't recognize them. Another bad mistake. He should have put his gaze back on the floor and moved on and hoped for the best, but he didn't. Instead, he said, "Excuse me." Then he raised his eyebrows and half-smiled in a self-deprecating way, like he was saying, "This is some place, right?" Bad mistake. Familiarity and a presumption of intimacy.
"What are you looking at?"
the Mexican said. At that point, James Barr understood completely. What are you looking at? That was pretty much a standard opener. Barrack rooms, bar rooms, street corners, dark alleys. It was not a phrase you wanted to hear.
"Nothing,"
he said, and realized he had made the situation much worse.
"You calling me nothing?"
Barr put his eyes back on the floor and moved on, but it was way too late. He felt the Mexican stare on his back and gave up on the payphone idea. The phones were in a dead-end lobby, and he didn't want to feel trapped, so he walked a long counterclockwise circuit and headed back to his cell. He got there okay, didn't look at anyone, didn't speak. He lay down on his bunk. About 2 hours later, he felt okay. He guessed he could handle a little macho bluster, and he was bigger than the Mexican. He was bigger than two Mexicans. He wanted to call his sister. He wanted to know she was okay. He set off for the payphones again. He got there unmolested. It was a small space. There were four phones on the wall, four men talking, four lines of other men waiting behind them. Noise, shuffling feet, crazed laughter, impatience, frustration, sour air, the smell of sweat and dirty hair and stale urine. Just a normal prison scene, according to James Barr's preconceptions. Then it wasn't a normal scene. The men in front of him vanished, just disappeared. They just melted out of sight. Those on the phone hung up mid-sentence and ducked back past him. Those waiting in line peeled away. In half a second, the lobby went from being full and noisy to being deserted and silent. James Barr turned around. He saw the Mexican with the tattoos. The Mexican had a knife in his hand and 12 friends behind him. The knife was a plastic toothbrush handle wrapped with tape and sharpened to a point, like a stiletto. The friends were all stocky little guys, all with the same tattoos. They all had cropped hair with intricate patterns shaved across their skulls.
"Wait," Barr said.
But the Mexicans didn't wait, and 8 minutes later, Barr was in a coma. He was found sometime after that, on the floor, beaten, pulpy, with multiple stab wounds and a cracked skull and severe subdural bleeding. Afterward, jail talk said he had it coming. He had disrespected the Latinos. But jail talk said he hadn't gone quietly. There was a hint of admiration. The Mexicans had suffered a little, but not nearly as much as James Barr. He was medevaced to the city hospital and sewn up and operated on to relieve pressure from a swollen brain. Then he was dumped in a secure intensive care unit, comatose. The doctors weren't sure when he would wake up again. Maybe in a day, maybe in a week, maybe in a month, maybe never. The doctors didn't really know, and they didn't really care. They were all local people. The warden at the jail called late at night and told Emerson. Then Emerson called and told Roden. Then Roden called and told Chapman. Then Chapman called and told Franklin.
"So what happens now?"
Franklin asked him.
"Nothing,"
Chapman said.
"It's on ice. You can't try a guy in a coma."
"What about when he wakes up?"
"If he's okay, then they'll go ahead, I guess."
"What if he isn't?"
"Then they won't. Can't try a vegetable."
"So what do we do now?"
"Nothing,"
Chapman said.
"We weren't taking it very seriously anyhow. Barr's guilty all to hell and gone, and there's nothing much anyone can do for him."
Franklin called and told Rosemary Barr, because he wasn't sure if anybody else would have taken the trouble. He found out that nobody else had, so he broke the news himself. Rosemary Barr didn't have much of an outward reaction. She just went very quiet. It was like she was on emotional overload.
I guess I should go to the hospital.
If you want.
He's innocent, you know. This is so unfair.
Did you see him yesterday?
You mean, can I alibi him?
Can you?
No, I can't. I don't know where he was yesterday or what he was doing.
Are there places he goes regularly? Movies, bars, anything like that?
Not really.
Friends he hangs with?
I'm not sure.
Girlfriends?
Not for a long time.
Other family he visits?
There's just the two of us, him and me.
Franklin said nothing. There was a long, distracted pause.
What happens now?
I don't know exactly.
Did you find that person he mentioned?
Jack Reacher? No, I'm afraid not. No trace.
Will you keep on looking?
There's really nothing more I can do.
Okay. Then we'll have to manage without him.
But even as they spoke, on the phone late at night on Saturday, Jack Reacher was on his way to them.